Hello, I'm Fred Stella, president of the Interfaith Dialogue Association. Welcome to another edition of Common Threads. Last week, we began our conversation with Eden Collinsworth. She is the author of Behaving Badly, The New Morality in Politics, Sex, and Business. A little bit about Eden. She is a former media executive and business consultant. She was president of Arbor House Publishing Company and founder of the Los Angeles-based monthly lifestyle magazine Buzz, before becoming a vice president at Hearst Corporation. She served as the chief of staff at the East-West Institute, a global think tank. In 2011, after writing a best-selling book in China for Chinese business people on Western deportment, she launched Collinsworth & Associates, a Beijing-based consulting company which specialized in intercultural communication. The author of I Stand Corrected, How Teaching Western Manners in China Became Its Own Unforgettable Lesson. And she currently lives in London. She is speaking to us from there right now. We welcome once again to Common Threads, Eden Collinsworth. Hello, Eden.
Hello. Well, thank you for having me back.
Certainly, certainly. So last week we talked a lot about morality or lack thereof, and ethics or lack thereof, in the world of business quite a bit. And I remember signing off and saying that we haven't gotten to politics. And what an interesting time. When you planned this book, when you started writing this book, where were we in the campaign season, or was it even prior to that?
Well, it was during the primaries. And so the book unfolds over a period of a year. And I must say that during the course of that year, there were so many changes, most especially in politics. I mean, it was the year of Brexit, and it was also the year of the presidential campaign. And I would come in and out of New York on a regular basis, I would say every 3 or 4 months. And it was interesting for me to, you know, as an American who has lived outside of my country for many years, but still is rooted, most especially in New York, to dip in and out and see how things had changed. And they were changing even during the course of the primary. It was frankly for me stunning to hear the vernacular and the rhetoric used, because that was new. I had never heard that before, not in America, not anywhere, frankly. And then that began to filter into everything. And this again, if one looks at the media and technology, the fact is that you know, what one has to remember that the internet, especially, is dominated by a very few very profitable tech giants, and their first order of business is to create profit and to increase the market perception of share value. And many of the business models are driven by the velocity and the volume of posts, and so that is also what drives the 24-hour cable stations, is ad revenue. And so what I saw and heard was the fact that despite what was being said was, I found offensive, it was repeated over and over and over again. And so by doing that, it was allowed then to become normalized. And so and what I realized towards the end of the campaign, and then after the inauguration, was that for the first time ever, taking the subway or the bus, I would hear things that I never would have heard a year prior, and they were pointed and racial and angry.
Oh, that's very true. What I found in this last campaign season, well, first of all, it would mirror a great deal of what you're thinking, except I had to live with it all the time.
Oh God, I can't imagine. This book was originally scheduled for the fall, and because of what has transpired this year, Random House or Doubleday, which is my publisher, moved it forward by 5 months, and so I have been back to New York more frequently than I would otherwise, and it's completely exhausting. I mean, when you listen to the news and you see it, first of all, it's constantly breaking, even though, frankly, it's not necessarily breaking news. That's what's coming at you. And, it's frenetic and slightly hysterical, and you just feel sometimes overwhelmed by it. So just the kind of intrinsic frenzy of it is, I find, exhausting. I frankly don't see how you all do it.
fortitude, ma'am.
Oh, God. Well, I've got to say, the last time I was in New York, which was just a couple of weeks ago, what I saw in the New York Times, of all publications, was a kind of a step-by-step instruction, their instructions on how to deep breathe in order to avoid getting too anxious. And I thought, when it gets to the point where the New York Times is giving you lessons on how to calm yourself down, you know things are really very grim.
what interests me, you and I have lived through more than a couple of presidential election campaigns. Mm-hmm. And I'm sure we know that on both sides, or sometimes there might be three sides or more, there's always spin, there's always exaggeration, there are always pointed attacks. But I think everyone who has lived through a few campaigns would agree, mm-hmm. this went completely over the top. And I am reminded, believe it or not, Donald Trump reminds me of Malcolm X. Because what was Malcolm X's motto? By any means necessary. Mm-hmm. There was nothing that he wouldn't say, and some of his peers on that very, very big stage with all of those lecterns during the primary debates weren't far behind him in terms of being willing to say virtually anything to
win. I think
win
that's
votes.
Right. I think that's absolutely right, and I think that what went missing was, and this speaks to the larger issue of what disallows you to say those things. And it used to be that there were institutions that prevented you from saying those things, whether it was the church or academics or your immediate society, your given town or village. And there was pushback. It seemed to have disappeared entirely, and it was allowed. And once it's allowed, then it's very, very difficult to hold somebody to account. And I must say, when I was in New York immediately after the election, I took the subway. I was downtown staying with friends. I had to get uptown, and it was early in the morning, it was rush hour, and by 42nd Street, it was a very crowded subway car, and now, actually, because you get internet connectivity, it's rather quiet. People are kind of glued to their phones, and so it was a fairly quiet period of time, but then someone at the 42nd Street stop inadvertently pushed someone else, not surprisingly, and the man was immediately accusational and very, very angry, and told this man, go, you pushed me. The man said, I didn't. He said, well, you did, and go back to Africa. And I thought, it was just stunning that something like that could be said. I would like to think that not many people believe that, but even if you do, it was, it's a rational form. The idea of saying it would never have been allowed. And there was this kind of stunned silence, and there was, there was a woman. I mean, all I saw were legs, frankly, because I had a seat, and so all of these were kind of disembodied voices. There was a woman who immediately said, you can't say that. I won't repeat it because it was a rather vulgar way of expressing herself, but very to the point. But she pointed out to him how stupid he was. And then she said, you cannot say that just because Donald Trump is president. You can't say those things. So, you know, it was very, for me, dispiriting. But at the same time, I was encouraged by the fact that there was instant pushback. And I must tell you, to stay with public transportation as a theme, because quite often that this is where these confrontations occur, because you're just standing cheek by jowl trying to get home. About a month ago, there was this terrible attack on Westminster Bridge here in London. It took all of 2 minutes. I mean, literally, it was less than 2 minutes to have caused that kind of carnage. It occurred just before 3 o'clock, and by 5:30, which was the London rush hour, the Arts Fund, which is their version of the endowment for the arts in the U.S., which I understand is threatened to be gutted.
Yes.
But the Arts Fund here in the U.K. pivoted very quickly and installed these massive signs above the turnstiles in some of the largest tube stations. So it's Canary Wharf and Victoria Station. And it was very simple, and it was above that you couldn't possibly miss it. And it was two words, a comma, and two more words. And the words were not them, comma, only us. Mm. And that held to moral account anyone getting on the tube. It not only galvanized, but it held to account people and their behavior. And I think that that's really crucial, whether it comes from an institution. I mean, the institutions now are kind of walking away in terms of their, their ability to hold people to account. But people can hold people to account. And that was one way of doing it.
Remarkable. Do you see with Brexit and with the new government, with May in power, do you see any normalization of Trump-like behavior coming out of them?
No, I mean, less so. I think that you will always have really bad behavior. I mean, it's not as though somehow any nation or culture is immune. I think that there's a different attitude here. And it permeates everything, whether it's the attitude towards national health care, whether it's the attitude towards supporting people who can't. It's a more gentle, frankly, from my point of view, it's more gentle than anything that I've seen in America. And America is a different country. It's based on individualism and independence. And I think Americans equate help or the need for help as a weakness. In other words, you pull yourself together and you get on with it. So attitudinally, it's different. I do think that I'm very encouraged by the first round of the French election, because that clearly was a vote of hope over anger or fear. And I'm hoping that one sees more and more the gradual, middle ground taking shape again. Some part of it is economic because of these huge income gaps, but I do think that people are beginning to draw more decisive lines around what is acceptable and what isn't.
If you're just joining us, you're listening to Common Threads on WGVU. I'm Fred Stella, and Eden Cullensworth is our guest today. She is the author of Behaving Badly, The New Morality in Politics, Sex, and Business. Well, we've got to talk about sex. So much of it has become normalized. That is to say, what was previously considered aberrant behavior is now considered normalized. Mm-hmm. Your chapter on your interaction with Ashley Madison was really, Really fascinating.
Yeah, it was fascinating for me too. I tried desperately to contain myself because I gather my facial expressions make it very clear as to what I'm thinking. So it was a challenge, but it was interesting. It was interesting for me on various levels, most especially as a woman.
Oh, I can imagine. For people who are not aware, Ashley Madison is a website where you can go to find people to have affairs with, and it really focuses on its target audience is married people, right?
Yeah, that's exactly right. It's a website specifically tailored for married people who wish to have illicit affairs with other married people. But this is a Canadian-based company that has an international reach. What one might keep in mind as an American is that, again, when I did research, you look at these polls or findings coming out of universities and so on. So whoever is doing this polling for their own purposes, that are something like 17 and 20% of American men who are married have been unfaithful. And something around the 10% level, between 10 and 12% of women, married women, have been unfaithful. But if you ask that same range of people, they will tell you emphatically that 90% of them will tell you that infidelity is immoral. So you can see that there is a disconnect between what people believe and how they behave. What was interesting to me, among many interesting things, in writing this chapter and researching in this regard, is that Ashley Madison advertises in many, many international cities. It's disallowed to advertise on buses, especially in Paris, in France. And so you would think that, they're fairly casual about extramarital affairs. In fact, in France, it's almost expected that the French president has had mistresses but they disallowed advertising on buses for Ashley Madison because there's a Napoleonic code that underscores the importance of respect in a marriage. So see, there's another example of ethical norms set by a specific society.
Do you think that it would be immoral for single people to pose as married people to find people to have affairs with?
Well, that was what I it was interesting during the course of my discussion with Noel Bitterman is his name, who's the founder and I believe he's still the CEO of Ashley Madison. What he volunteered was that the growing list of clients were skewed more towards women, and that in that category, something like 35% were single women, which was completely baffling to me. And I started to think, well, perhaps these young women, and they're on the young side. The men were older, and the women were not surprisingly younger. And I thought, well, why would a single woman make a point of seeking out married men? And perhaps it's because, frankly, it's a kind of a viral minefield out there, and you assume that you're less likely for that to occur, if you're with a married man who is less likely to be promiscuous. Or perhaps it's women who are, focused on their career and simply don't want an emotional connection. And so this prompted me then to consider the larger issue of whether, from a woman's point of view, and that's the only point of view I can have being a woman, whether, that women have been, their sexual curiosity and appetite, whether that has been held in check by conventional morality and now has been released, so to speak, with technology, or certainly encouraged by technology or facilitated by technology, but also simply because it's a different time. So in my mother's time, you were not at liberty to have sex before marriage because the consequences were life-changing, and you eliminated most of your options if you got pregnant, and weren't married as a result, didn't get married as a result. In my time, I was, you know, a generation or two after the pill, and so there was no fear of, or less fear, certainly, of getting pregnant. But still, you know, as a single woman, there was the sense that, you know, I should be, not to personalize, but any single woman should be keeping the number of lovers she has to kind of single digits, otherwise she could be considered loose. And now, in fact, the idea of being loose or counting lovers is completely beside the point. I just don't think that is the same perspective among 20-year-olds or people in their 20s.
Right. And we seem to have adjusted ourselves as a society to that. We've adjusted ourselves to, say, cohabitation, right? Mm-hmm. How do you send out wedding invitations now? You send them out differently than you did a generation ago because two people may be living together. And hotels no longer ask for marriage licenses. Mm-hmm. You know, have we gone? This is not a question I'm asking you to answer, but the rhetorical question is, you know, where does it end? Have we gone overboard when now we have to deal with, 12, 13, 14-year-old girls saying that providing oral sex to a boyfriend is no big deal because it's not sex?
For them, it isn't sex. And so, and I started to think about when it stopped being a sexual encounter. And quite honestly, that occurred when Bill Clinton insisted that he didn't have sex with that woman. And in fact, he had some form of sex with that woman. He certainly had a sexual encounter. But, so what's curious now with these, again, this has to do with technological advancements, is that now, you know, with Tinder and the opportunity to kind of swipe your way in and out of sexual encounters, it seems to me, I often wonder whether women, young women, are providing oral sex to men or young men in order to establish the possibility of a relationship. So, I also am not unaware of the fact that it's not reciprocal. In other words, it's what's the focus is the gratification for the man, not the woman. So, you know, all of these are interesting points. If you think of the number of people that in the Middle Ages, for example, you might meet during the course of your lifetime, and granted it was a shorter lifetime, but still, you'd be lucky to meet at the most 100 people during the course of a year. Now you can swipe that at a bar or a cafe in a question of hours. And so, you know, that is, again, that I think that technology has hurled us forward, or certainly in one direction, that isn't necessarily going to retreat. And so whatever the normal is, that's it. It's not as though it's somehow going to go back to something else.
I think perhaps one point to consider is that in the matters of sex, in the matter of business, certainly, and in simply the matter of how we live our lives, we are focused on instant gratification. Would you agree that?
I think that's right. I think that we have a shorter attention span. I think, again, that's been facilitated to some degree and encouraged to some degree with technology. Things move very quickly. I also think that I know that, you know, the current generation, the younger generation, by that I mean young people predominantly in their 20s who've grown up with this kind of technology, have less, I wouldn't call it respect, but they give less credence to institutional standards of ethics and what is right and wrong. And theirs is a far more varied and expansive view. And so they will take their cues from social media, you know, sports figures, spirituality, their own, you know, peer group, celebrities, And so they're, you know, I'm coming at morality with, you know, it's as though I feel that in order to do a math problem, I must memorize, you know, multiplication tables. And they ask me, why bother when you can reach over to a calculator? What's the point? And theirs is a germane perspective, actually, for their time. And the lines are far more porous, and the sense of morality is far more flexible.
Do you think that as civilization has progressed over the millennia, do you think that there have been times where there have been these kinds of challenges where morality has been questioned, has been redefined, remolded to fit the society in which it serves, and then just organically it writes itself?
Well, I think it, to answer your first question, I think this is these times have been times of profound change. And so I suspect that during the, you know, if you look at various cultures, or if you think of China and the Cultural Revolution, or you think of the Industrial Revolution, or any number of revolutions, I'm sure that people living during that period of time were just as overwhelmed with the changes. I think that somehow this is a kind of bizarre, you know, perfect storm where things are coming together and moving forward, and we are one musical step behind. So, for example, with artificial intelligence, that will move forward with or without us as we're debating the pros and cons. That will simply move forward because technology does that. It's not going to linger as we figure it out. And so I think that this is a particularly challenging time. I don't think that predicates, you know, morality. Or I don't think it, in other words, I don't think there's the threat that morality will simply disappear. I think it becomes something else. And it's not necessarily my version of morality, but I think people will always draw lines around what is acceptable and what isn't. And the encouragement for me is to see that because of these changes in America and politics or in with money making, people are actually becoming better informed citizens, and they're becoming more responsible in vocalizing their objections. And so I think that in that way, there is hope. I feel that it, you know, one has to hope. Otherwise, you just crawl under a rock, frankly.
Well, that's a positive note to end on, and we must end as we are out of time, Eden. But this has been a great conversation, and last week as well. I thank you so much for joining us.
Well, thank you for having me. I enjoyed it as well.
You've been listening to Common Threads on WGVU. I'm Fred Stella, and with me today, Eden Collinsworth, the author of Behaving Badly, The New Morality in Politics, Sex, and Business. Please join us again next week, won't you? Right here on WGVU.